Welcome back to the Young China Watchers podcast. We're a network of young professionals interested in China. Our 10 chapters around the world organize virtual and live events with China experts. My name is Sam Colomby. Our guest for this episode is Bill Bertels, East Asia correspondent for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. In October 2021, Bill released his book titled The Truth About China, Propaganda, Patriotism, and a Search for Answers. Our multimedia editor, Joshua Cartwright, spoke to Bill about his book and about his sudden forced departure from China in August 2020.
Can you talk about how you first got to China and what your initial impressions of the country were?
Well, the very first time I went to China was back in 2008, just before the Beijing Olympics. This was a period where in, say, Australia, there was a newly elected Mandarin-speaking Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd. There was a mining boom where Australian companies were cashing in big time on Chinese demand. So it was really this sort of time of a lot of excitement in Australia about China and this idea of the Asian century and everybody should learn Mandarin. And my goodness, the potential, the possibilities are endless. So I was sort of swept up in that a bit. I started learning Chinese back in Australia, but I went to Beijing in 2008, just a few months before the Olympics, to study the language there and then to backpack around. And unfortunately, I only had the budget to stay there for a couple of months before I had to go back to work in Australia, but it certainly gave me a taste. And I quit my job in 2010, just 2 years later, and went back to study the language there full time before deciding to stay in China, needing to get a job, obviously. And my choices were either teach English or work in Chinese state media because I had a media background. So obviously chose state media. And even then, post-Olympics, it was still pretty exciting in a way because I went into the Xinhua News Agency. And yeah, it was a bit of an eye-opener in some ways. It was quite interesting. It was a good time for me to learn, improve my Chinese, make some friends and contacts. But yeah, after 12 months of doing that, I thought, well, look, I want to be working as a correspondent over here. But the only way to do that is to go back to Australia and sort of work your way up and get posted. It's possible, but difficult to try and sort of hustle your way in when you're already in China. So I went back to Australia and then ended up going back for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation in 2015.
Next, I want to sort of fast forward to your sudden departure or ejection from China, however you want to put it. What happened?
Well, at that time, Australia-China relations were getting dicier. And so a lot of people were seeing the diciest elements of the relationship when there were conflicts about trade issues or Australians getting locked up in jail. So what had happened is I'd been told that a friend of mine, Chung Lei, had been detained. She's a CGTN news anchor, Australian-Chinese. But the thing is, I'd only just found out. I'd actually heard rumors about it a week earlier. And this is such bad instincts for a journalist, but I didn't believe it. I thought, oh, that's far-fetched. And somebody I knew who knew her really well kind of fed me a line to try and get me off the trail because they were trying to deal with it behind closed doors. And I stupidly kind of believed it because I didn't think this person would tell me a porky about this. But I was hearing these people from outside of China saying, oh, we think she's been detained. And I thought, oh, that's a bit far-fetched. It's not that dangerous over here. People aren't getting yanked off the street. But then it got confirmed to me in no uncertain way that, yes, she had been detained and remains detained to this day. And I'd only just found that out a few hours earlier. And so I was preparing a story on it. It was a pretty big story in Australia, China at the time. I mean, she was very high profile for the Australian Chinese community. Anyway, then I get this call from one of my bosses back in Australia, and he said, we've been told by the Australian government that you need to evacuate China ASAP for your safety. And I sort of thought, where's this coming from? What's this about? And I said, I'm doing up a story on the arrest of Chung Lei at the moment. He said, what are you talking about? I don't know anything about this Chung Lei arrest. And I said, oh, well, look, this is what I've just found out this morning, quite a big story. So we obviously thought the two things were linked. We ended up meeting at the Australian embassy where the Australian diplomats were very clear that, yes, we want you out. We can't really tell you exactly what this is based on, but we want you out. So I suppose this was the most frustrating thing at the time. You know, you're being told to pack up immediately and flee the country, basically, and you know that you won't be going back. It all escalated to the point where the Australian government advised the diplomats in Beijing to keep us in the embassy. We went there to have a chat to them to try and get some clarity. And in the end, they said our advice is you don't leave the embassy, you don't go back to your apartment, you stay there. And my fiance is Chinese and she was with me, and we just found out the news about 5 weeks earlier that she was pregnant. We'd been affirmed by the ABC that we were going to stay in China for at least another year. So we said, let's see if we can start a family with a kid up here. And it was all falling into place. So you can understand how I was thinking about it from a personal level. I was thinking this is not the time to be getting evacuated from China. But the context was COVID had kind of shut down all the flights. So it wasn't easy. If it was a different time, the diplomatic staff might have encouraged us to get on a flight that afternoon, but there were no flights that day or the next day. It was really, really hard. So we ended up in limbo in the Australian embassy for about 4 or 5 days. Very sensitive situation, particularly with my wife now, but my then fiance's Chinese national. I mean, that's what I was most worried about, of course, that the Australians are sheltering a Chinese national because her partner won't speak to the Chinese police about a national security investigation, which is what they're claiming that I'm a person of interest for. You know, the whole thing was just utterly bizarre. And it culminated with the Australians negotiating with the Chinese that the China would lift its exit ban on me and the other Australian journalist who was embroiled in all this. In exchange for both us journalists separately doing police interviews for this national security investigation, supposedly that we were wanted for, not as suspects, but as persons of interest. So I ended up doing this surreal sort of police interrogation with, it was filmed. There were 3 or 4 cops there in a Beijing hotel room. The conversation kind of went in circles a bit. They were asking me about Chiang Lei, but they were asking me about more broad questions about Australia, China, about Hong Kong national security law and my reporting on it and this sort of stuff. And it culminates with them sort of saying, all right, you know, that's finished. You're free to go. And I made some sort of joke on the way out because I was kind of pissed off. I sort of thought this whole thing's a bit of a farce and it's not a good reason to be getting shafted from China. And there was like a bottle of wine on top of the minibar. And I made some sort of joke on the way out about, well, can I at least take this bottle of wine? And this Beijing cop, you know, was like, yes, yes, take it. You know, cheap, have it. And it's like the whole facade broke down in that last moment where the cop, you know, wasn't taking it seriously. And I went back down and the Australian diplomats were there to escort me back to the embassy, and sure enough the next day we're on a plane, and that was that. Our exit ban was lifted and we were out. And so technically speaking, we weren't kicked out of China like many of the US media journalists have been. It's not like our visas were cancelled, but we were placed in a situation where I think the intention from the Chinese side was to prompt the Australian government to evacuate us, which is exactly what happened.
And of course, that story is the opening of your book, The Truth About China: Propaganda, Patriotism, and the Search for Answers. So why did you write it, and what is the truth about China?
Well, I think that title should have had a question mark on the end of it. That's why there's the Search for Answers. So And the thing with that title, I'll just say, I suggested about 30 other titles to the publisher, but, you know, they need to sell books. They want a tabloid title. So, of course, I've had a few people when I did do book events say, you know, what kind of arrogant foreigner writes a book claiming that he knows the truth about China, you know? And I said, well, this wasn't my preferred title, but the point about the search for answers is what is the truth about China? It's very difficult to find given the opaqueness of the system. I wrote it partly because I read a book by Evan Osnos called, I think it was The Age of Ambition or The Time of Ambition or something. He wrote this incredibly thrilling, interesting account of China on the ground from an outsider's perspective. But it was very much a snapshot of its time, of the who, when era. And I read it several years later, and already I could see how much things had changed under Xi. So I thought, I've been in China as a reporter for 5 years during a really interesting time when Xi Jinping's China really came into clear focus. And you had the beginning of the proper China-US rivalry. It included the Trump years, the trade war. From an Australian perspective, you had this stunning deterioration in diplomatic ties between Australia and China, which will never be fully reversed. And you still, though, had, for the first few years of my time as a reporter in China, you still had the relative openness where private sector companies, for example, would be willing to cooperate with the foreign media to do stories. Access to academics and so forth wasn't particularly difficult at all. And then I really saw it tighten in those years. So I thought, for a book that captures a snapshot in time, it would be a useful thing for particularly people who want a bit of a 101 on China, what it feels like on the ground from an outsider's perspective, to see it through Australian eyes. I thought it would be interesting. And luckily for me, with Xi Jinping staying in power, the book isn't really dating because it's kind of still the same. So actually, it's still quite relevant.
Going back to the experience you had of having to leave China so suddenly, and what you've called being a pawn in a diplomatic tussle, what does that say about how China has changed in the past decade, and how has it affected your own views of the country?
At the time when we were caught up in this situation where we had the national security police at our door and, you know, Beijing police interviews and that sort of stuff, the two Canadian Michaels were in jail. You know, these were two Canadian guys who were very obviously taken as diplomatic hostages. There are two Australians sitting in jail for national security crimes still. We don't know if hostage diplomacy is a factor, but I probably wouldn't still be in jail if diplomatic relations were a little bit different. So we've seen a bit of this in recent years. We've seen it with a Swedish guy, Gui Minhai, who was an author of books about Communist Party leadership. Don't know if he's in jail or he's somewhere, but he's controlled in China. He's not back in Sweden. And he too appears to either be a hostage or a political prisoner or whatever you want to call it. So we've seen a bit of it in recent years. It did, particularly with the two Michaels, because it was just so blatant. It did really point out just how cutthroat the game had become. And the idea I had in 2010 of, let's go to China and, you know, why don't I work in the state media for a year? You know, who cares? I'll just be an English editor. You know, James Palmer, a really prominent voice on China, he worked at the Global Times for 7 years, just bashing their English copy into shape. I don't think anybody would voluntarily do that now. To me, what's really changed is to work for Chinese state media kind of has become a bit of a political choice. And 10 years ago, Chinese propaganda was kind of stodgy, a bit North Korean style. But now, in many ways, it's just outright hostile and nasty. And you get quite a few foreigners who are making a little name for themselves by being the face of that nastiness. You know, as a foreigner, there's a pretty low ceiling of how far you can go in Chinese state media. So that might be as good as it gets for them. Good luck to them. But even if you worked as an editor or something in CGTN these days or in China Daily or whatever, it feels like a much greater political choice to do that sort of work than maybe 10 years ago when you could have just been doing it for a visa to learn Chinese and get to know the country better. So that's what it feels like to me, to work for the foreign media as a Chinese national, to be a journalist for the foreign media is seen in China now as a political choice. We've got staff at the ABC who on a few jobs were called traitors. For example, there was a human rights court case we were covering, and you had these thugs who were sort of sent by probably the Ministry of State Security or some department. And they were there to try and get in the way and to give everybody a hard time. And some of them were calling my cameraman a traitor and that sort of stuff. You know, it's nasty.
To follow up on that point about the difficulties that your Chinese colleagues face at, you know, an organization like the ABC or another non-Chinese, you know, foreign media outlet, you wrote about a Chinese colleague, a producer who actually left the ABC because, and this is a quote, she realized the overseas media wasn't the force for constructive criticism she hoped it would be. and that audiences responded more to simple narratives about China rather than nuanced, complex takes. What do you make of that? And what steps do you take to, as you say, do justice to covering the China story, given all the challenges of reporting in China?
The end of the day, I think each media outlet in their own way, you're restricted by the medium. You get some story that on the ground is kind of a bit unclear and there are different perspectives on it. And there's not a clear, sexy headline for the story because the reality of it is a little bit murky. But then back at base, you're dealing with editors who they're not following it closely and they're not that interested in it. And they might read on some sort of more tabloidy website a clear, sexy headline and go, oh, wow, you know that recent rumor about the coup?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and we didn't touch it because, you know, I'm not stupid. I didn't do anything on it. But I got requests. I got, oh, this coup in China, man, that's a massive story if true. Can you look into it? You know, particularly in China where the simple narrative is to look at Xi Jinping and to look at the party and to look at the state media and to kind of see it as one homogenous whole and to not kind of elevate the more moderate voices. Particularly Taiwan's a good example. We can talk about it later, but the idea that the Chinese government says certain things about Taiwan, it's building up its military, it throws out lots of propaganda about Taiwan. And so that means China is, you know, threatening an imminent invasion. That's a sexy, clear headline that people want to read. But then when you say, look, in reality, if you look at the situation, it's unlikely that anything will happen imminently blah, 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 then that really tones it down a lot. And it's not like coverage of China is unique in that foreign media is sometimes accused of beating things up or simplifying things. But I think because the basic knowledge about China among the populace in Western countries is probably a bit lower than it is for other countries where they already can speak the language. You know, we know more about America than we do about China. We know Australians know a lot more about Britain than we do about China. Right. I think for that reason, it seems particularly unnuanced and particularly bad when the foreign media simplifies things too much when they report on China.
Coming up more to the present day, after leaving the mainland, you're now based in Taiwan. How does reporting from Taipei compare to reporting from Beijing?
You know, I got to say, I think being in Taiwan to cover China is sort of the least worst option. Taiwan's wonderful. It's a lovely place to be based. And there's a good access to people in government, people in the military. And so it's really good place to report on the China-Taiwan story. It's a great place to cover domestic Taiwan news. But to be honest, for audiences abroad, there's not a huge amount of interest in that. But to cover China itself, there really is no good option aside from being in China. You're just really out of touch when it comes to things like the property sector, right? Big ongoing slow burn story about Evergrande and property companies that are in trouble. You can't really get a sense of that or easily speak to people caught up in that unless you're in China itself.
And you glanced on this already earlier, but from your vantage point in Taiwan, what do you make of these dire predictions of a Chinese attack on the island by, insert symbolic year here, 2049, 2027, or even before 2024, as the U.S. Navy chief warned?
Mm. Yeah, I think 2049, very, very, very likely. Very, very likely. It would still make sense for China to wait until the 2030s just to close the military capability gap. I think the next few years is not super likely, but the wild card, of course, is Xi wanting to do it in his own time for personal legacy. Does he want to do that? He appears to be an incredibly ambitious man. So I don't think the next 5 years is likely, but 2027 to 2032, if Xi remains in power, I think the likelihood goes up. And whether it's Xi or somebody else beyond 2032, I think it really starts to go up. I just left China under the impression that the Communist Party had whipped the nation into such a nationalistic frenzy about taking Taiwan that they've sort of boxed themselves into a corner where they need to do it at some point. Now, Xi continually bangs on about the Great Rejuvenation by 2050. Now, he presumably will not be in power in 2050 or 2049, depends how long he lives. But whoever it is, you know, they're setting themselves up for failure if they get to 2049 and they have to explain to this nation that has become feverishly nationalistic about Taiwan, oh, we haven't made a move because I just can't imagine that situation. So it's kind of awful because it appears from being over here in Taiwan that the Chinese Communist Party has completely failed to try and persuade the people of Taiwan to peacefully give themselves up to China, which is what Beijing's been aiming at in the entire time, right? They actually do want peaceful unification. So it's really grim outlook, but I think the 2049 deadline is real. And living in Taiwan, it's kind of unimaginable to think about. But then I suppose we look at Ukraine and, you know, these sorts of things unfortunately are a little bit clearer now to picture than they were a few years ago.
What about among people in Taiwan? Do they feel the same sense of inevitability about Chinese invasion?
No, everyone's got a different view, but the Taiwanese government and the Taiwanese military certainly feel that way, particularly the government, the current government, the way they speak about it. Hard to tell with military because, you know, the way that military commanders tend to talk, it always sounds a bit dramatic, but you get the impression that they also think the threat is growing simply because they're the ones doing the intercepts. But the person on the street often will just talk to people and they'll say, look, if the Chinese do come, then there's nothing we can do. We'll just run and hope America comes in because there's nothing we can do. That's a really common sentiment. I think there's a common sentiment too among quite a few people that basically they're not going to do it. Why would they do it? We're the same culture. They're Chinese. We're basically Chinese. They're not going to do it. I think that's a sentiment that a side of politics, the KMT side, probably is more common. But then, yeah, there are a lot of people who seem to basically say, look, we've lived with this rhetoric and we've lived with this supposed threat for decades. And so we're kind of tired of hearing about it. So, yeah, we just get on with our lives. So there's a lot of that as well.
Well, I'm going to try to end this on a lighter note because, you know, tons of people who are interested in China, you know, dream of becoming a reporter. So, like, what advice do you have for those people who are interested in the country and want to do what you do despite all the pessimism?
Because I got into it in a different era, it was easier. Now it's really hard, but I would still say learn Mandarin, really read widely, really read and engage with the sort of Chinese Marxist viewpoint. I did that sort of thing you do when you first get to China where you're exposed to different ideas. Back in 2008, I was like, wow, gee, you know, the West has been horrible to China over all these years. And I can understand all the anger and so forth. And, you know, a real eye opener. But then you kind of go through this period, particularly as a reporter, where you go, gee, they're secretive here. And they really are very oppressive with the censorship. And, you know, so you kind of, the more you read, including from Chinese government or Chinese government supporter accounts of their worldview, the more informed you're going to be. And I went to China and I worked for state media. I would not advise that now. I just think they'll try and press you to do little YouTube videos about how horrible the West is. So I wouldn't do that now, but maybe go to China and work in some other capacity. Heck, even teach English for a year or something, at least just get some exposure to the place. Keep your connections open. Maybe you can freelance a bit for the media. Maybe you can get posted over there from abroad. That's it, really. I do think in today's environment, you probably can't be as opinionated on social media about China as you once could have been, because even for fairly benign commentary, you might be denied a visa. But yeah, it's still incredibly important.
What would you recommend, either, you know, whether it's reading, listening, watching, to really understand China, especially now?
This sounds like a plug. It's not. I don't get paid by them, but I actually really like The Economist. I think David Rennie, their correspondent in Beijing, very experienced China head. Su Lin Wong, an Australian, she's recently done a podcast series on Xi Jinping. I think The Economist is really sharp because they do inject a bit of their sort of editorial viewpoint. They do see China through the sort of economist lens, which they apply to everything. But I just think they're very sharp and pithy. And so I very much enjoy their writing on China. As for a new book or a recent book, I've just started reading Spies and Lies by the relatively young Australian researcher, Alex Joski. He grew up in Beijing partly. He's got an interesting background. He's very much a sort of China security head. He's actually been banned from China. Him and another academic were formally banned in a bit of tit-for-tat diplomacy between Australia and China, not that he was planning to go. But Spies and Lies is interesting. It's all about China's MSS and covert operations. It's kind of delves into the history behind the MSS and its establishment. I think this topic is only going to become more prominent in the coming years about Chinese influence operations and covert operations in Western countries. It's already come to the fore, but I think it's going to become sort of more widespread. You'll hear more from the Chinese side alleging US covert operations in China. We're starting to see China getting on the front foot, trying to attribute cyber attacks and so forth to the US. I think this is going to become really, really prominent as a back and forth between those countries.
Thanks again for taking the time. We really appreciate you coming on.
All right. Thank you.
Take care.
That was Bill Bertels, author of the book, The Truth About China, Propaganda, Patriotism, and the Search for Answers, interviewed by Joshua Cartwright, our multimedia editor. Visit youngchinawatchers.com to find out about upcoming events, chapters near you, or to watch one of our webinar replays. My name is Sam Colomby. The music for this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions.